this is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Sangmi, in mid-January, let's say on January 16th, how many new COVID cases did South Korea have?
3,859.
Okay. And a couple of months later, March 16th, just actually, what, 2 weeks ago?
621,328.
Wow. Okay, so this is Sangmi Cha. She's the Seoul Bureau reporter for Bloomberg, and she joins us from Seoul, South Korea. So what you're saying is that between January and mid-March, cases in South Korea rose 100-fold, about?
That's correct.
Okay. Wow. And as you reported, that 621,000-plus case count on March 16th on that day was the highest anywhere in the world. Okay. So what about, though, the fatality rate in South Korea? How did that number change over the course of those same 2 months?
It changed from down from 0.91% to 0.14%.
0.14%? Okay. So, Sangmi, there's a remarkable story intertwined in all of those numbers. Because what I'm hearing is that in South Korea, COVID cases have shot up tremendously in just a couple of months. But the country maintains one of the lowest fatality rates anywhere in the world. And at the same time, the country is loosening its restrictions. So I guess here's another way to think about it. The United States has one of the highest COVID death rates in the world, almost 300 deaths per every 100,000 Americans. But in South Korea, that number is one-tenth of that, just 30 deaths per every 100,000 South Koreans. Now, I got those numbers from the Coronavirus Resource Center at Johns Hopkins University. So we're going to talk this hour about how South Korea is able to achieve that, those really different poles here. So first of all, Sangmi, what is it like right now in South Korea? I mean, what kind of restrictions are there in the midst of this, you know, huge surge that's going on?
Right. So we just talked about the highest daily count, but looking at the weekly tally, the officials here tell us that we have Korea has passed its peak in COVID cases, at least the weekly tally. Last week was the peak with an average of 490,000 cases for that week. So the cases have been falling, but we're not seeing a plunging number of cases. It's rather a gradual decrease in numbers. And that's because we have the Omicron variant that is still spreading here. And as for the COVID curbs, we still have the limited gatherings up to 8 people, and the closing hours for restaurants, cafes, and movies and other places for 11 p.m. But the government is actually thinking of easing those measures, and the new announcements will be made this Friday.
This Friday. Okay. And what about other measures like masking? What are the rules and guidance around masking in South Korea?
Masking is not, it's definitely mandatory. I mean, the government never really said that, but it's already a masking culture here. Even before COVID, if you have flu, people would just mask up. So you can actually find no one who is not wearing mask here on the streets or even in offices. Some of the places do have lesser of the masking guidelines indoors, especially in offices, but still most of the offices still keep that mandate. And what we hear from the government pressers on a daily basis is exactly how the government officials wrap up their pressers would always be stick to washing your hands and wearing masks.
Oh, interesting. But they stick to offering those as recommendations. To be clear, you said the government never mandated masks. Is that right?
I mean, it is a mandate, but it is mandated, and there is not even the point of discussing whether it is a recommendation or a mandate, because everybody does that, and it is still the curbs in fact, and the government actually did say that mask will be the last that comes off of those COVID curbs.
I see. Okay. But that's an interesting distinction that you just made about how it sounds like there really, even if the government hadn't mandated it, there wouldn't have been a need for one anyway, right? Because you said there's just no distinction between the automatic adoption that the Korean people had of masks and the government saying that it was an important thing to do.
That's correct, right?
Okay. So then take me back. You've been in Seoul, what, for the entirety of the pandemic, Sungmi. Take me back to the very beginning, February, March 2020. What was South Korea's first response like?
South Korea was actually one of the first countries to experience COVID pandemic outside China. And so it was very quick in terms of its response. It really focused itself on the 3T strategy, the T formula that the government says, namely test, trace, and treat. So even up to now, the government is sticking to that deployment of that testing regime, which many of the countries around the world have abandoned now that the COVID is becoming endemic. So here it is quite normal that people, if you have the symptoms or if you have contracted someone with COVID, would go test themselves at home, and they would not stop there. But if you test positive from the at-home test kit, then they would run down to the healthcare center or the public center, and then they would get tested, which is the PCR tests. So the government actually spent around $1.3 billion so far on the PCR tests alone. So, and that's why so many of those testing has led to the astronomical case counts. Mm. But going back to the earlier days of the pandemic, Korea was praised for its aggressive testing and contact tracing. And I'm sure you have heard of the drive-through testings that started here, and a lot of the oftentimes even invasive contact tracing that the government imposed on each and every cases of coronavirus.
Because people had to what happened? I have to say, Sungmi, to be perfectly honest, it's been so long that my memory's a little bit hazy. So what, when you say aggressive contact tracing early in the pandemic, what do you mean by that?
What I mean by that is basically there were these epidemiological investigators, or the contact tracers, both from the KDCA and from local governments, where they would involve a lot of the GPS, so mobile GPS data tracking, or they would track the credit card records of the patient and track down every possible contact, starting 14 days before a patient starts to show symptoms. So that would actually lead to so many of the clusters. That's why Korea was able to actually find those cluster infections in the beginning, and was able to have the country's cases, at least the COVID cases, under control without a full lockdown or extremely tough restrictions.
Oh, that is fascinating. Okay, so their contact tracing was very comprehensive. And that's still going on to that degree?
No, it's not. In January, actually, the Korean government they rejected that approach of the the contact tracing using the high tech tracing and the, as I said, the GPS data and the card transactions. Even what they're doing right now is more of shifting their focus on the forward-looking investigation, so-called, which is instead of tracing a patient's visit to high-risk facilities. So instead of tracing every patient's visit to high-risk facilities, such as nighttime entertainment businesses and gyms, what the virus fighters are doing now is they're focusing on tracing close contacts, those who are most likely to get infected, such as family members, friends, and work colleagues.
Uh-huh. Which makes sense at this point in time of the pandemic. But another key thing that you had said, though, is that aggressive contact tracing early on allowed South Korea to never have a lockdown, right?
That's correct. And what the government is saying, their approach to this changed approach to contact tracing is because they're now focusing singularly on the fatality rate and clamping down the number of hospitalization that will ultimately lead to more deaths. So as you have mentioned, we have been seeing a lot of the mortality rate falling all the way to 0.12% as of now.
Mm. Well, this hour, we are talking about the trajectory of the COVID pandemic in South Korea and how, for example, a couple of weeks ago, South Korea actually clocked the highest number of single-day COVID cases in the world, but at the same time, it has one of the absolute lowest mortality rates anywhere in the world. So we're seeing what we can learn from South Korea's example, and we'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're taking a close look at the example set by South Korea. The country has been on a completely different trajectory during the entire course of the COVID-19 pandemic, and we're looking at what lessons the United States can learn from South Korea's example. And I'm joined today by Sungmi Cha. She's Seoul Bureau reporter for Bloomberg News with us from Seoul. And also joining us now is Dr. Jerome Kim. He's Director General of the International Vaccine Institute, an adjunct professor at the Graduate School of Public Health at Yonsei University, and an adjunct professor at the Uniformed Services University of the Health Sciences, a military medical school in Bethesda, Maryland. Dr. Jerome Kim, welcome to you.
Hi, Meghna.
So first of all, can you tell us a little bit more about what you think, what changes regarding COVID restrictions the government in South Korea might make, as Sungmi said, that might happen on Friday?
So the government has taken a very incremental approach to releasing the controls that were put into place. You know, as Sungmi had noted, when the government made the decision to start loosening the controls and to stop tracking and tracing as intensively as they had before, they did that essentially for practical reasons. When they hit a certain number of infections per day, that kind of intensive follow-up became nearly impossible. Mm-hmm. So what they did to prepare for that, which is actually probably the most important thing in a pandemic response, preparation, is that they ensured that as much of the population that was eligible for vaccination would be vaccinated, and that a majority of people would again be boosted, so that as Omicron started in Korea, which was January, You know, 95% of the eligible population had a full course of vaccination, and probably on the order of 80 to 85% of people who were eligible were boosted. That meant that as Omicron took off, even though the number of people who had been infected in Korea was minuscule at that point, people were protected against the most important thing, which is hospitalization and death. Mm-hmm. And that's what vaccination does. So if you combine that, if you think of this as a layered defense, the first layer is distance and hygiene. That's masks and hand washing and things. And it still kind of works in Korea as opposed to other countries. Then you have vaccination as the very strong second line of defense. That really significantly reduces hospitalizations and deaths. And we've seen data not only from Korea, but from Europe, from Israel, from South Asia, from Korea, that it really does work and do what we want it to do. But then there are always going to be people who get infected and will progress. So it's really important then to have a backup system. And the Korean government did a good job of that. So if you test positive on your rapid test at home, you're over 60, you go to the healthcare center, they confirm you with a PCR. They then give you a kit that has a thermometer and a pulse oximeter and meds for, you know, symptoms. And you download an app that, you know, basically tells people at the health center how you're doing on a daily basis so that they can kind of monitor you at home and take care of you at home. And if you progress, then you come in and you start getting the treatments that will keep you from requiring, going into an intensive care unit. What they've done is they've essentially,
can I just jump in for a second? So they just hand you this kit. If I'm stumbling over my words right now, it's the sound of an American feeling a little bit of disbelief, although I do believe you. Is this because, does Korea have universal health care? Because you're describing a scenario that I find unimaginable in the United States.
Yeah, so Korea has national health care, but also the government is actually, for COVID, not necessarily relying on the insurance system, but is covering the cost of COVID care. And, you know, I think, and you realize, I mean, the Kaiser Family Foundation put this out, the cost of unvaccinated people in the United States during the Delta and then the Omicron outbreaks was over $30 billion, mm-hmm. the hospitalization costs. So the government's policy in Korea of vaccinating as many people as possible voluntarily really help to reduce the impact of the surge that we're seeing now. Although, again, and Sangmi didn't necessarily talk about this, but the peak was not so long ago. And you remember that from the peak of infections, it's another week to 2 weeks before you see the peak in hospitalizations. Mm-hmm. And right now, intensive care units are a bit over 50% occupied. And so the government is watching very closely to see that the intensive care units are not going to become full again.
Yeah.
Now, they have backup as well. And again, this is a part of planning. When you're planning a release, you have to make sure that you can take care and prevent people from going to the hospital. And you do that by having progressive care in place to take care of people as they're breaking through, as they're developing more symptoms.
Yeah. So, Dr. Kim, to interrupt here, but I want to turn back to Sangmi for a moment, because Sangmi, you've reported on this. Can you talk a little bit more about, you know, what you've learned and seen regarding that progressive care that's going on right now that Dr. Kim was talking about?
Right. I mean, the Korean government has been preparing for this actually for some time now, and they're really focused on the preemptive testing and treatment of the patients according to the severity of the symptoms. And a lot of the experts have mentioned that Korea has very good ICU capacity, and the hospitals are have that resources to help prevent death, and so the government added more of that ICU beds, and now runs about 2,800 ICU capacity. And as Dr. Kim mentioned, they are now 68% of them are in use. But these are not all. The government has more of those beds for milder symptoms. And again, most of the people who have the mildest symptoms or asymptomatic cases, which is about 1.8 million people, are treating themselves at home right now.
Mm-hmm. So what I'd like to do actually is almost sort of look at South Korea's response to COVID layer by layer, working our way from sort of the public health infrastructure that South Korea has down to Dr. Kim and Sungmi, what you've both said about the nation's current very high vaccination rate. So Dr. Kim, let's start up at that higher level about public health infrastructure. Because while South Korea's response to COVID is exemplary from what you're both describing, it wasn't that long ago. What was it, in 2015, when there was a MERS outbreak, the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome in South Korea, where things went a little bit differently? Can you remind us what happened then?
Yes, and so a Korean citizen was transiting through the Middle East and acquired another coronavirus, the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, which differs from SARS-CoV-2 in that it is less transmissible, much less transmissible, but has a much higher mortality rate. So at that time, we were looking at mortality rates reported of between 30 and 40%.
Wow.
Compared to what we know, you know, now with SARS-CoV-2 at 0.12%. But, you know, and it was a severe outbreak. You know, in the end, about 236 or 7 people were infected. But at that point, you know, the government had screened off people. There were yellow tapes around things. You know, the government was trying everything possible to track and trace, but they didn't have the tools. And it was often deemed a failure of the hospital system, of the isolation system, of isolation practices. And so the government internalized all that and changed the law. So they put in place the law that allowed them at the highest level of pandemic operation. So when the government declares a pandemic emergency, then they can access credit card information and cell phones, and they use it under particular circumstances. So for instance, there was a large outbreak in some gay dance clubs, and you know, people didn't want to know other people to know that they had gone, and there were some issues, and the government couldn't get people to come in for testing.
Mm-hmm.
So they activated, and the companies keep this information for 30 days. Again, this is all a part of the law. And so the government said, we're activating this set of cell phone towers, and we're going to find everyone who turned on their cell phone for a 4-hour period on the following nights. They found the telephone numbers. They sent out emails or text messages to people saying, you might have been exposed. Please come in and be tested. When people didn't, they said, okay, we understand. We'll make it anonymous. So you just came in and they sent the result back to a cell phone number. There were no names. But it got to the idea that, you know, they needed to be able to identify people if this strategy was going to continue to work.
Indeed.
And but it developed, and all of the laws were put into place in the interpandemic period, between outbreaks, which is when you probably can do your lessons learned and then and then think about what would work better in the future.
Dr. Kim, I'm just going to jump in here because I'm in the role of the American whose mind is blown, okay? Because everything that you described just now, I mean, we have more or less, not everywhere in the United States, but the similar technology to achieve that here in this country. Granted, there's cultural differences, legal differences, et cetera, that would have to be addressed. But you're painting a picture of a whole approach to pandemic control that was never even, vigorously discussed in the United States. And it goes even further than that, because I understand that, you know, you were talking about that inter-pandemic period. And that, what was it, in December of 2019? So a couple of months before COVID really broke onto the world stage, there was a tabletop exercise with health officials in South Korea. Can you tell me about that?
Yes. And so as a part of the pandemic planning, they would do these occasional tabletop exercises. And in the December version of it, and this is anecdotal, I've never heard a person an official tell me this, but there was a tabletop exercise, and they actually use academics around Korea as well. A man and a woman returning from China with an unknown respiratory illness. And that tabletop exercise occurred, you know, a month before the first cases started to appear in Korea. But that was an important part. You know, the government internalized the failure of the system in 2015 and came up with a series of changes that were then passed by, you know, after debate in the National Assembly. So, you know, and I have to say, as an American looking and working in Korea, it was very interesting. You know, I came back and I, you know, one day got a text message from our local health center that that someone appeared at our supermarket between 10 o'clock and 10:15 after having returned from this place, has now tested positive. If you were at the same supermarket between 10 o'clock and 10:15, you should, if you develop symptoms, you should go in and be checked.
Sungmi Cha, jump back in here. Tell me more about what you know regarding that sort of interpandemic period that Dr. Kim described that seems to have played a big role in setting up Korea for much greater success when COVID came along.
Right. What I actually did hear, what the government official said about that tabletop exercise. So I can actually confirm that. And the KDCA had said multiple times that that's one of the lessons that they have learned from the MERS outbreak. And also the, as you said, that period where we had no pandemic. But the government keeps telling us that it is one of the key lessons that they have learned during that time is to continue to officially diagnose most of the infections in the country, to identify the at-risk cases, the vulnerable groups, and preemptively hospitalize and treat those patients before their conditions become worse. And we have to talk about the vaccination rate, yes, which is very high, as you said. It's also one of the highest booster shot take-ups in the world, precisely 89% for people age 60 and above, which is remarkable. So that has definitely the key reason behind the declining rate of the death rates and the hospitalization rates. So even though we are seeing more of the death toll right now, because obviously because the cases are high, mm-hmm, the daily cases, but again, when compared to the fatality rate, and with that's again one-tenth of that of the U.S. or the U.K.
Mm. So I definitely do want to talk about Korea's high vaccination rate. We've got about 2 minutes before our next break, but let's start doing that. Because did I hear correctly that the number, it may be as high as 95% of Koreans are fully vaccinated, Dr. Kim? Is that right?
Of the eligible population. So the children don't get don't start their vaccinations until tomorrow, I think the 31st or the 1st of April.
Children at what age?
But of the eligible population, right.
Children of what age?
Of the 5 to 11-year-olds.
Okay. But 95% of eligible population, fully vaccinated or at least one dose?
Fully vaccinated.
So that's 30% higher than here in the United States, I think. The question is how? How did South Korea achieve that rate? We've got a minute before our next break, Dr. Kim, but how would you begin to answer that question?
You know, there was a lot of anticipation. People wanted to get the vaccine. They understood that the pandemic restrictions were there. They hoped that the advent of vaccination would allow people to go out to do more of the things that they had done before. They looked on it as a solution to the restrictions that were still in place. Never a lockdown, but it wasn't like it was in December of 2019. So people looked on this, and the government talked about it as, you know, this is the way out. And the problem here, again, and this gets to, you know, as you're looking at the statistics and the numbers, there would be 500 cases, 1,000 cases, 3,000 cases, and it would go back down. And once you achieved a certain level of vaccination, it was kind of clear, and the government was hinting that at some point they were going to switch and stop looking at infections and start looking at, you know, other things, other metrics.
I'm so sorry, Dr. Kim. We just have to take that quick next break. And Sungmi Cha, hang on here for a moment. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
Smart journalism. Fascinating topics. Words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and I want to give you a little heads up about what we're talking about tomorrow. We're going to be looking at how Russia and the far right here in the United States share disinformation with each other. For example, that story about the United States having bioweapons labs inside of Ukraine. How did that story emerge? So we want to hear from folks. Do you watch Russian news sources or social media? What are they telling you? What do you believe? Are you hearing the same stories on, say, Fox News with Tucker Carlson? And what, if any, divides or not do these conflicting narratives have or are causing between friends and family? Tell us at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That's for tomorrow's show. Today, we're trying to glean some lessons from South Korea's example on the trajectory it has experienced regarding the COVID-19 pandemic. It's quite a remarkable one. And I'm joined today by Dr. Jerome Kim. He's Director General of the International Vaccine Institute and adjunct professor at the Graduate School of Public Health at Yonsei University. Sungmi Cha joins us as well. She's a bureau reporter for Bloomberg News in Seoul. And both of them join us from Seoul today. I actually want to, we're talking about the high vaccination rate in South Korea. And I kind of want to get nitty-gritty about it, if I could, with both of you. Sungmi, let me start with you. I mean, when vaccines were first made available in South Korea, where did Koreans go to get them? How hard were they to access? What was the system like to get those shots in arms?
Right. The as you said in the beginning, it's been a while. It's been 2 years, so I am recalling my memories. And I assume it was February. It was the end of February last year when the vaccination drive started here. And as Dr. Kim has mentioned, everybody was so excited and they wanted to get the shots first, but the government's policy was to start with the most vulnerable groups, and especially the frontline workers, as well as the staff and staff in nursing homes and the patients in nursing homes to protect them from severe cases. So the general public actually had to wait until around summer to get their first shots. And even despite this sluggish start, and that was because the government was very much focused on the WHO's COVAX system. But despite that sluggish start, they rolled out the vaccines very fast, and people were taking part and doing their jobs to roll up their sleeves. And as I mentioned, nearly 90% of the elderly population have also gotten their third shot now. And the government also has started its fourth shots for the elderly and some of the at-risk groups.
Mm. Yeah. So, Dr. Kim, let me turn that same question to you, because the reason why I'm prying on this front is because, you know, public health measures are only as effective as the percentage of the public that they reach, right? And so, as you know, like in the United States here, once vaccines were made available, the rollout was somewhat similar, right? To the most vulnerable populations first, to the elderly, to healthcare workers, et cetera. But then when the general public got access to vaccination, it was really kind of rocky, right? It depended on the state that you lived in, and or if you had internet access to book an appointment at your local pharmacy or maybe at a mass vaccination center. People would spend hours in the morning like trying to grab a slot to get vaccinated. It was not the smoothest of experiences. So that's why I'm really wondering, what was it like for Koreans in the general public? Was it easier? Like, could they just walk to the local health center and get a shot? What was it like?
So it's interesting. And as it was being rolled out and as they were stepping down in age, unused vaccine became available. And there was an app that you could download that would tell you if you could go to a certain center to be vaccinated, because they had excess vaccine, because people didn't show up or for whatever reason. And I remember people at work saying, I've got to go. I've got to go get my vaccine. And but remember the Korean internet or Wi-Fi system is particularly good. You know,
it's extraordinarily good. Yeah.
And the apps were available to help you find vaccine in order to get vaccinated with whatever was left over. And so, you know, I think that helped. And the government hit their target. Their target was to be at 70% by the fall, and they hit that. And then, you know, one of the other things to emphasize is that in November, we saw this spike in cases. It was the Delta, and it actually filled up the available ICU capacity for COVID patients. I mean, we were at the maximum. And the government realized that the people who were getting sick were the elderly who were vaccinated in the very beginning. They needed to be boosted. And the campaign to get people boosted was very intense over the month of December. And that prepared people, actually, luckily, for the Omicron outbreak in that started in January.
What did that campaign look like?
It was, you know, if you're above the certain age, you need to be vaccinated, you need to be boosted again, or you need to be fully vaccinated and then boosted. So it was a real campaign to catch up, to make sure that everyone was fully boosted and that the people who were at risk were vaccinated or had received a booster.
I mean, was it on TV? Was it radio ads? Was it, you know, push messages sent to phones? How did the word get out? Yeah.
Maybe Sangmi would be better able to answer this because I don't watch Korean TV or listen to the radio, but perhaps Sangmi will have.
I could help. So I remember last year, it was November when the government actually imposed vaccine pass mandate or vaccine passports in the beginning. And that was their aim to usher in the living with COVID strategy, which they have put on hold for some time now. So this vaccine pass mandate would mean that in high-risk venues, which they call indoor gyms or saunas, bars, and karaoke bars, you would not be able to enter those if you don't have a proof of vaccine. So up until just a few weeks ago, actually, that was still the case here. So that vaccine pass mandate was extended to other venues such as restaurants even. Mm. So if you don't have the QR code system that you could show upon entering the place, you couldn't go dine. But they lifted that measure now that the vaccination rate is high enough.
Yeah. So I will note that we've done several programs on this show about the realities of sort of vaccine pass programs in the United States and the particular issues that they face here, including civil liberties issues and political issues as well. So that actually leads me to the cultural differences, if I can put it that way, that have led the United States and South Korea on such different trajectories, as I've been saying, regarding COVID. So Dr. Kim and Sangmi Cha, if you can just hang on here for a second. We also spoke with Gi Hyun Yang, a student at Boston University who's been in Korea since April of 2020. And he's seen public attitudes toward COVID changing in recent months.
Before, people were cautious when they're dining out or in group settings. But I think the approach now is, if you get it, you get it. And if you don't, great.
Gi-hyun says catching COVID is now considered normal. And part of the reason why is because symptoms haven't been as bad as they were earlier in the pandemic.
The symptoms aren't that serious. Your throat hurts a lot, but after that, people seem to feel okay. So they just go about their business. And if you get COVID, you just take a break.
And when he says take a break, Gi-hyun is referring to South Korea's current requirement that people who test positive self-quarantine for 7 days.
What's so interesting about Koreans is that we're really good at keeping the rules. We always wear masks. We'll complain, why do we do this? But we still keep up with everything that we're supposed to.
Now, currently, South Korea has that extraordinarily high vaccination rate that we've been talking about. However, Gi-hyun doesn't feel that things are back to normal by any means, even after 2 years of strict adherence to the rules.
Every time it feels like it's over, a new variant comes up. When I'm working on film projects, I need to work with a lot of people. And because of COVID restrictions, like the number of people that can congregate, it just makes things so difficult. So I really hope COVID will be over soon. I'm just so sick of it.
Gi Hyun Yang is a student at Boston University who's been in South Korea since April of 2020. So, Sangmi Cha, talk to me about sort of the public's role in South Korea's success, if I can put it that way.
What we heard from Gi-hyun is actually very, very similar to a lot of the vox pops or the friends and people that I talk to say. Compared to the headlines that have been alarming, you know, reporting world-topping cases. But every day, even though Korea is seeing hundreds of new cases, it is correct. People are going about their own business and nothing seems out of control. Everybody is going to school and work. And people are very good at following the rules. That is correct. They are keeping the mask mandate, and everybody is willing to go and take the vaccines, even though in other parts of the world there were some of that pushback towards the vaccination. So there is definitely that participation of the general public that shaped the success of South Korea. I mean, we looking at the sheer numbers, the COVID numbers, it might be difficult to say a success, but definitely looking at the strategy that the government is focused on, the minimizing the mortality rate and hospitalization rate, they are doing very well. When for a country that has reported 11 million cases since the start of the pandemic in 2020.
Yeah. Well, we're headed towards the last few minutes of the show here. And I do want to hear from both of you about, okay, so what are the lessons that the United States could learn? Because I think there are some fundamental differences, obviously, between these two nations. I mean, Dr. Kim, you talked about how there is a national health in South Korea. I'd also note that perhaps the overall health of the South Korean people is maybe likely better than the overall health of Americans. I mean, the life expectancy of South Korea is 4 or 5 years higher than in the United States. But at the same time, all the other factors that both of you mentioned, from that inter-pandemic period preparedness to the very aggressive and quick test and trace that allowed South Korea to never actually need a full lockdown, those high vaccination rates. Dr. Kim, I suppose what I'm asking is, do you think that the United States could have actually achieved something similar to what South Korea did, were it not for, I don't know, our politics here?
Yes, so that's a great point. And actually, the Korean government did at one point earlier, and it seems like so many years ago, credit the Korean people and their attitudes and support for the government policies around COVID for a good part of the success. And I think that's key. But I think one of the things to remember is that the Korean government system is different. It isn't like the federal government, 50 state governments. When we reach this level of pandemic emergency, the prime minister runs the show. And from the top all the way down to the people working in health centers, they know what they're supposed to do and what they're supposed to say. You wouldn't get that if the president were speaking and Texas or Florida decided to do something else. So there was a uniformity of command, control, and communication, which if you're fighting a war against a virus, you think, well, maybe that would be a good idea. I don't know if the United States could ever put into place a policy like that. In Australia, remember they formed a government of national unity because they have a state system also.
Right.
And the premiers of the different states were sitting on the cabinet in order to unify the government approach. I mean, I don't know how the United States would do that, but command and control was important. There's really actually pretty good support for vaccination in general here. Vaccination rates are very high. So there isn't the same strong anti-vaxxer movement. Although I have to say, they're a little concerned because among the children, the reservation rate is still very low. So moms aren't signing up. We don't know if that's just because the program is early or because there is actually some reluctance to get the children vaccinated. So, but there's in general pretty strong support. Pediatric vaccination rates are very, very high here. In general, there is trust for the government around this issue. Mm-hmm. And, in the United States and in some of the other countries, Brazil might be another example, there was just complete disbelief and a dissociation between the top of the government and what was happening on the ground. And, yeah. And when that happened, and you can see where in the world that happened, there were usually bad outcomes associated with that.
Right.
So, the United States was viewed as being the most prepared for pandemic emergency in 2019.
Yeah, but now
it
we
gets
have
to the point that
yeah,
even if Korea is ready, it's yeah. ready right now.
Exactly. Well, and now we have other nations like South Korea to look for to as examples. Dr. Jerome Kim and Sungmi Cha, thank you both so much for joining us today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.